In a world where uncertainty reigns supreme, where shadows of chaos dance at every turn, one truth emerges unyielding. Preparation is not a luxury, but a lifeline. Behold the Wellness Company, a beacon of readiness amidst the tempestuous seas of fate. Envision a sanctuary of tranquility, where the tumult of unforeseen medical crises finds no purchase. The Wellness Company's Medical Emergency Kit stands as a bastion of assurance, a fortress of resilience against the unseen foes of health. Within its sacred confines lie the tools of salvation. Ivermectin, to ward off the insidious whispers of disease. Emergency antibiotics, to quell the raging storms of infection. Antivirals, to vanquish the relentless tides of contagion, and more. The Wellness Company Medical Emergency Kit is not merely a collection of supplies, it is the embodiment of preparedness itself. Crafted by the hands of esteemed healers led by luminaries such as Dr. Peter McCullough, Dr. James Thorpe, Dr. Harvey Risch, and Dr. Drew Pinsky, this kit stands as the pinnacle of safety, the zenith of prevention. These truth-seeking doctors have forged a testament to vigilance, a testament to the unwavering pursuit of well-being. Embrace the certainty that comes from being armed against adversity. Embrace the Wellness Company, for in its embrace lies the promise of resilience, the promise of a brighter tomorrow amidst the chaos of today. Don't wait for the next crisis to strike. Visit twc.health/strangeplanet and use promo code STRANGEPLANET for an exclusive 10% discount. Prepare today and rest easy tomorrow.
18 years from tonight, Grant Gill will become a comedy legend when he totally kills it at his improv class's graduation performance. Knees will be slapped. Hilarity will ensue. That's why he's already keeping himself in shape and razor sharp today with wellness tips and tools from AARP to help make sure his health lives as long as he does. Because the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Learn more at aarp.org/healthyliving.
Hello? I'm a Marine.
No matter how you served.
My buddies from the Army are all gone now. I'm really alone.
No matter what you're going through.
I keep getting calls about the bills, and I'm trying to get a job. I feel so stuck.
We are here for you. If you or a veteran in your life is experiencing thoughts of suicide, dial 988, then press 1 to reach the Veterans Crisis Line.
Conspiracy Unlimited with Richard Serrett.
I had a couple bosses I worked for in the Baccarat pit who got in trouble for bookmaking. They had an illegal bookmaking operation in the Dunes Hotel, and they were being watched, and somebody informed on them, and they got arrested, and a group of 5-6 guys were indicted for a bookmaking operation, and so two of the guys went to jail. They went to the county farm temporarily because they were in contempt of court for not talking. They wouldn't testify. We had a policy in the Dunes at the time where the bosses were in with a tip, and if you got fired, you were in for a year until you got a job. So it was my job to take the tips to the jail. That sounds crazy, but I actually took the tips, we called them tokes, to the jail, and I gave them their tips in jail. This was like a kind of like an honor farm out in the east side of Las Vegas. And the conditions were pretty bad. I mean, the furniture was terrible. And so Sidney Wyman at the Dunes Hotel bought the entire jail furniture so those guys could be comfortable for a while.
Did you know you can now stream episodes of this podcast on your mobile device? All you need is my Conspiracy Unlimited app. It's absolutely free, and it's available for both iOS and Android devices. If you're a Conspiracy Unlimited Plus member, pay attention. You can now stream premium content from your mobile device. My free Conspiracy Unlimited app for iOS and Android, available from the App Store and Google Play. Get yours today and start streaming Conspiracy Unlimited on your mobile device.
Conspiracy Unlimited with Richard Serrett. Pursuing the truth wherever it leads. Exposing evil and corruption and the secret machinations of powerful elites. Revealing the high strangeness beneath the surface of our supposed reality. Coming to you from his studio beneath the stairs. Here's Richard Serrett.
And
I'm Don Jeffries, and you can find me. I'm the author of many, many best-selling books, Hidden History, Survival of the Richest, Crimes and Cover-Ups in American Politics, 1776 to 1963. You can find me at donaldjeffries.news, donaldjeffries.media. And I've been on Richard's show many times, and he's been on my show. Great friend, admire his work very much, very honored to be on the show. Our guest tonight is Gino Minari, who is, it looks like he's, you know, one of the, almost the founder of Las Vegas. I guess he moved there in 1964. His resume is incredibly impressive. He started Houdini Publishing in 1992, still currently doing it. He's a publisher and writer of literally hundreds of publications covering varied subjects. We're going to talk about his book on Las Vegas today. He collaborated on many scripts for some many well-known movies like The Rain Man, Indecent Proposal. So, Gino Minari, welcome to the show.
Hi, Don, and thanks for asking me to come on. It's a pleasure indeed.
Oh, well, it's just fascinating. I mean, you know, this world is amazing to me. I mean, geez, you've led such an exciting life. I mean, if you go past the casinos now, are you like somebody that, you know, works at a restaurant, they never eat there? Do you just kind of ignore that because it's old hat to you?
Well, you know, that was always the old story, you know. People think that if you live here, you live in one of the hotels. You know, actually, I think I haven't been in some of the new ones. I don't even know what the new Wynn looks like on the inside. I should go over there. But when I moved here, just right out of high school, the same week I graduated, I went to the dunes and different hotels and watched the poker rooms. My eyes opened up, and I couldn't believe what I saw. So I went to UNLV, and I got a job in the nighttime working as a busboy at the Sahara Hotel, and I worked with all the dealers there that told me stories. Every 20 minutes, the dealers would change and come in and have coffee. They worked 40 minutes on, 20 minutes off. And I got to know all these guys and heard all these stories. I just was fascinated. I just couldn't stop. I wanted more and more. But that's part of how this all started. And so I was working as a busboy. I'm making a little money, and I get off at 7 o'clock in the morning, and I'd go have a little breakfast, and I took flying lessons. So little place where I took flying lessons. That's where I met one of the owners of the Dunes Hotel, who eventually gave me a job when I was 22 years old. So that's how it started. I went to work at the Dunes Hotel, like in 1968, and I just couldn't wait to get to work. It was the most exciting thing I've ever seen in my life. I mean, I went to work an hour early just to be there. So all these things, I decided to, you know, the place was such a great place. The owners were great guys. You know, there was eight management teams, you know, when the Dunes started in 1955 and, of course, closed in 1993. But I was there in the middle of it with the most successful management team, which was Sid Wyman, George Duckworth, Charlie Rich, Howie Engel, Butch Goldstein, and a couple of other guys. It was just absolutely wonderful. These guys, you know, they didn't have smartphones. You know, they did things just out of their brain, out of their pocket, you know, and they made the place successful. The best of everything, the best gambling, the most exciting thing in the world. And what turned the Dunes around, being that it was a little bit outside of town in those days, you got to remember the Dunes now is where the Bellagio sits. So if all you people have been to Las Vegas, you know where the Bellagio is. That's the famous Dunes Hotel. And that was where the Dunes was. And it started off with 200 rooms, then it grew to, you know, like the 1,200 rooms. And the key thing that made that place successful was bringing and buying business, plus filling their rooms up. So the more business that they had, the more gambling they had. And these junkets would come in from New York, it started with, and they'd come in on a Thursday, leave on a Sunday, and every other week New York would show up, and then in between that one, you'd have Detroit, and Chicago, and so forth, and so on. And also, you know, the Dunes had a 18-hole championship golf course. That was another thing. And so it was a great, great place to work. I couldn't wait to get to work. I started there as a blackjack dealer. I heard you say that when the show started. But I wound up as a Baccarat executive when I last left the Dunes. And that was, at that time, one of the most prestigious jobs to even get in the casino. I was working downtown breaking in to learn the games. And you have to do that in order to basically be able to work in a first-class place. So I spent about a year downtown, a year and a half, you know, dealing blackjack, roulette, and a little bit of craps. And I went out to the Flamingo to try to get an audition, they call it, like a tryout. And the guy, I could deal fairly well. He said, you're not ready. And I thought I was, but I think he just didn't want to hire me. I was get too many people wanted jobs. I walked outside. I saw the Dunes Hotel, and a light went on in my head. I said, you know, George Duckworth, I met him at the airport when I was learning to fly. I'm going to go over there and see if I can get a job. I get an audition. I walked across the street. I got on the table. He was there. He said, get on the table and deal. I dealt, and he hired me on the spot. And that was the start of it, 1968. And then at home, I wanted to learn Baccarat. So we built a table, me and a friend of mine, Ray Medrano, who wound up to be a successful employee at Caesar's Palace, the Baccarat department. We learned Baccarat. And we learned it, you know, just a little bit at home. So, you know, about 6 months of dealing blackjack in the dunes, I got the nerve to walk up to Mr. Duckworth. You know, you never bothered these guys when they were in a bad mood. You could tell they were in a good mood or in a bad mood. You knew, you know, when to talk to them. It was not like, you know, you get an appointment. You just took your shot. I walked up to him and I said, Mr. Duckworth, I said, you know, I'm practicing Baccarat at home, but I would like to go over on the table and work for free if I could, just to try to learn the game. He says, buy yourself two tuxedos. You're starting tomorrow night. And he left me hanging there and he walked away. And I tried to tell him, oh, wait a minute, I don't know the game. He didn't make a difference. They stuck me right on the game. And that was the start of the whole thing.
So, baptism by fire. Boy, I just want to make sure, because I neglected to give out the title of your book, because all your entire fascinating career can be found in a very large book you wrote called Las Vegas's Dunes Hotel, Casino, and Country Club, The Mob, The Connections, and The Stories by Gino Minari. So, and it's, you know, it's just a fascinating. Yeah, I mean, you've led a really, really interesting life. I imagine you know that. I mean, most people do not have this this kind of background, but you sound like you're really appreciative. And you started out at the very bottom. I guess, you know, in 1964 or whatever, it was still possible in America. I don't think it is possible to do that now, to start, you know, a mailroom level and rise up to being some kind of an executive or whatever you wound up at. But just kind of an American success story.
Well, you know, I really, you know, I always felt myself I had to do better and do a little more than just the average guy to be successful. I wanted to be the best at what I did. And, you know, I thought I was going to go into aviation, actually, but my eyes weren't good enough. And so I couldn't get a job with the airlines. And so there I am in the Baccarat pit. And how this whole thing, you know, I don't think I was even aware at the time of the strength of the so-called mob, the outfit, the syndicate. You know, that wasn't what the dunes was to me. It was like, hey, I'm just going to go to work and make some money and have a good time. And I couldn't wait to get there. Till one day, the guy, one of the floor men at the dunes in the day shift, was a guy from New York. His name was Taglia Lalatella. And he was a guy with them's and these kind of an accent. And he was what he was. And I didn't know much about him at the time, other than he was a decent guy and he had a lot of experience and was in Baccarat in the old days and at the Sands. And he also, you know, dealt paper craps. That means dealing with paper means with cash, not with chips. And so one day when they stuck me over in the pit on the day shift, he was the boss. And as I got off, you know, he got to know me a little bit, and a couple of months I'm getting off the table after I was calling the hand in Baccarat, like the stick man, you sort of call it, where you, you know, call the cards. And as I walked around to get on the other side of the table to work another 20 minutes, he says, come here a second. Would you please read this memo to me? My eyes are bothering me. And so, you know, I looked at it, and I kind of explained it to him. And he said, thank you. And ever since that day, you know, I didn't embarrass him. I felt that maybe he wasn't the best learned reader in the world, you know. And there's a couple of words that he didn't maybe know, but I didn't embarrass him, and I helped him. And from that day forward, he took me under his wing and showed me, you know, about this game and how to deal it and what to do and, you know, and so forth and so on. And then one day he said something to me. He's very, very friendly with me, invited me to his house. His wife used to cook Italian food. We go out to eat. You know, one day he said to me, and he points to himself, and he says, you know, Gino, he says, I can never be fired from this hotel. And I looked at him like, what do you mean? You know, I didn't get it. He said, if my man could walk through here, he'd pay $50,000. All of a sudden, a light went on in my head, and I figured it out that he was pretty connected to somebody. And so that's what I started looking at. Every day, I saw something new, and another light went on. I saw another situation where, what are those guys doing? What are they doing? And what about that guy? And so forth. And then you'd have unusual customers that bet enormous amounts of money. You say, where did they get this money? And anyway, it was like a story, like watching a movie every single day.
Well, I guess so. And you're young when you start, obviously. And this is obviously an exciting world to you. You're giddy. You talk in the book about Wally Cox. I loved Wally Cox. You know, and his kind of odd odd couple friendship with Marlon Brando. But and I guess he had a very short tenure there in the Dunes. But what were some of the big celebrities that came through the Dunes and performed there? And then did you get to meet any of them?
Well, Wally Cox lasted 4 days, by the way.
Right.
So, you know,
yeah, right.
And Marlon Brando was in the audience screaming. Now, and I wasn't there then. This was back when they first opened. The Dunes was basically taken over after Peepers by the Sands Hotel, and Sinatra worked there. And and then they didn't last too long. And then finally it was put together by a couple of – there was landlords and there was operators. And Riddle and a couple of other guys, Major Riddle, that was his name, Major Riddle, not an officer, but that was his name, who was a very close friend of Hoffa and had a trucking business, took it over. And then they started these the Minsky Follies. They brought Minsky in, and they had Abbott and Costello and all kinds of guest stars. But through the course of the Dunes, the years of the Dunes, they had a gigantic floor show. And then they had a small lounge show called Viva La Girls. It was a French-style review. And in the main showroom, Casino di Paris, a cast of 100. So it was not – occasionally they'd have a guest star that would sing in the show, like Lynn Renan and Rovan and other people. But it wasn't like the Sands Hotel where they had one headliner, Frank Sinatra. It was just a different operation. It worked, though. It worked for the Dunes. It brought people. They could price it right. They had it worked out. They had the best food. They had the Sultan's Table restaurant, the most beautiful place you ever saw in your life. One night we were in the Baccarat pit, and John Wayne was walking through the casino. And one of the other floormen was kind of gutsy. I'll never forget him, Attilio Panaccio. And that night Lenny Stelly was with me and Dick Brewer. Tilio Panaccio, Tut, we called him. He said, hey, Duke, say hello to the boys. And just in the style of John Wayne, he kind of walks kind of like he does in the movies, and he goes, hiya, fellas. Everybody gave him a round of applause. It was, like, wonderful. And, of course, one of the most interesting things, one of the owners of the Dunes Hotel, Sid Wyman and Cupie Rich. Cupie Rich was his partner. His real name was Charles Rich. I don't mean to use that in an inappropriate manner, but that was his nickname as a kid, but no one ever called him Cupie. Cupie had a little boxing gym in St. Louis, and where Sid Wyman and him had an absolutely fantastic bookmaking operation. Now, this is leading somewhere, so I want to just give you this. And so they actually used the Western Union agents to accept bets for them all over the country and send them to them in St. Louis. And they paid the agents a commission for getting the business. They did some big business. Like, they'd gross $7-8 million a year in 1949 and 50. That's like incredible. And so in St. Louis, Charles Rich met Cary Grant, met him at a sports function or something, and they became the best of friends. And two opposites, a little guy about 5'2" and Cary Grant about, dashing movie star. He used to come to the Dunes all the time, and was a fabulous guy. People would recognize him completely. They'd go crazy, they'd scream. One time at the cage, a lady was in front of him, and he was right behind her, and he had his glasses on, and he wanted to be not noticed. And she got done with her business. She turned around real fast, and she dropped her purse, and he bent down to pick up the contents. The lady looked up to see who it was, and she almost fainted. She screamed, "Cary Grant! Oh my God!" But he was a nice guy. He was a fabulous guy.
incredible actor, incredible personality. So you got to at least see these people. Did you ever get to interact with any of these celebrities that were walking through the casino or performing there?
Well, you know, you knew you kept your spot. You know, you didn't go over your.
Yeah,
spot,
you didn't overstep.
I mean, but
right.
The bosses were the bosses. That was their business. You know, but one of the bosses that hired me, Mr. Duckworth, he had an English wife, Kim Darvis, that was her name, and she was a beautiful lady. She's passed away. I'm so sorry to hear about that. But, you know, one day, Cary Grant, George Duckworth, the casino director, and his wife were just leaving the Sultan's table, and he said that Cary Grant leaned over to George's ear, and he says, "Does your wife have a sister?" And, you know, basically, mm-hmm. you know, he thought she was just absolutely fabulous. You know, as mm-hmm. far as interacting with him, I would say no. We kept our business. We minded our business. In other words, we were asked to talk, we talked. We just didn't take over like, I would have to say it's a little different today. Today, the people would act like they're their best friends, and that's not the way it really is. You know, you respected their privacy, and you left them alone, you know.
Except, well, go ahead. No, I said, do you still live in Las Vegas? Do you go to any of the casinos now?
I do occasionally. You know, once in a while, I like to play poker. Or some friends in town, we go out to eat. I might, well, since the COVID thing, of course, not recently, but we go out and we'd play blackjack a little bit or just have some fun. But, you know, it's always fun to see the gambling, see how the new games are running and see how they run things. And, of course, you know, the way I look at things and the way things are run today, Two different points of view. You know, the bosses at the Dunes Hotel, they were the contact of the players. They were the handshakers. They were the guys that came up to you and basically, you know, touched your belly, basically, you know. And they were the ones that took care of you. And they had a following. And they were loyal. Those customers were loyal to them. Today, you know, I don't think, and I'm not trying to belittle anybody, but I don't think the executives of the hotels you don't want to even meet a customer unless he's the best customer in the house. You know, it's just a different business, too. It's a different business.
Yeah, well, obviously things. I mean, I live on the East Coast, and we used to go to Atlantic City quite a bit. And Atlantic City, boy, I mean, they were devastated several years ago when they legalized. They put some casinos around here, very close to us in Maryland and in parts of Virginia and in Philadelphia.
Foxwoods.
Pardon me? Yeah.
Foxwoods.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess Las Vegas doesn't have the same concerns, but Atlantic City is really doing poorly now compared to what they were because of the competition, aren't they? Things have changed there.
Well, you know, there is a lot of competition. And, you know, but Las Vegas is Las Vegas. People love Las Vegas. I don't know what it is. They love the idea of the mob used to run it. They love the fabulous hotels. But, you know, if you go to you go to another location that has gambling, you know, I mean, Reno's kind of nice, but you go to other places in California or wherever, it's just not the same. It just doesn't have the excitement. You know, once you leave the casino, where are you going to go? To like the Denny's restaurant? There's nothing else going on, you know? So, I just think there's no replacement of Las Vegas. It's the excitement. It's the entertainment capital of the world. And I think that's the key to it. Entertainment, reasonable food, and inexpensive rooms. You know, I didn't only work at the Dunes. I worked at other places. And I worked at a place called the Imperial Palace, which is now the Link, which is across the street from Caesar's.
Can you hold that? Hold that thought, Gino.
Hello? I'm a Marine.
No matter how you served.
My buddies from the Army are all gone now. I'm really alone.
No matter what you're going through.
I keep getting calls about the bills, and I'm trying to get a job. I feel so stuck.
We are here for you. If you or a veteran in your life is experiencing thoughts of suicide, dial 988, then press 1 to reach the Veterans Crisis Line.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Wearing a Men's Warehouse outfit makes you confident, like you could do anything, so you dance like no one is watching, even though everyone is watching. Because of the Men's Warehouse outfit, you interview like the job is already yours because it is. Because of the Men's Warehouse outfit, you golf as if the rules don't apply to you because you're too well-dressed for rules. Because of the Men's Warehouse outfit. At Men's Warehouse, get measured, get fitted, get hot, get confident in everything from tailored suits to underwear and all the stuff in between. Love the way you look at Men's Warehouse.
At IKEA, your dream home is a blue bag away. No matter the size of your space or budget, we've got everything you need to turn your dreams into reality. And now with new lower prices on hundreds of our most popular products, bringing the dream home is even easier. Like the gray Strandom wing chair, was $369, now $299. And the IKEA Plus 365 nine-piece cookware set was $129.99, now $89.99. And hundreds more. Shop new lower prices at IKEA-USA.com today.
What can I say about ESS 60 I haven't already said? It's a miracle in a bottle. ESS 60 is pure carbon 60. And carbon 60 is a miracle molecule that earned its discoverers a Nobel Prize in chemistry. I've been taking a tablespoon of ESS 60 for my friends at C60 Evo every morning. What a difference it's made in my life. It delivers better health, mental clarity, and immune support. I'm pain-free, energized, and I'm sleeping better than I have in decades. ESS 60 from C60 Evo is a powerful antioxidant, 172 times more powerful than vitamin C. It's a known antiviral, antibacterial, and anti-inflammatory remedy that really works. And now you can experience C60 Evo's new Advanced Facial Serum, the groundbreaking new anti-aging formula that incorporates ESS 60, plus 21 organic, natural, and vegan ingredients. This luxuriant formulation is specifically blended to soften and heal your skin. Put it on at night, enjoy the subtle rosemary essence, and awaken to noticeably softer skin. To get your ESS 60 and C60's new Advanced Facial Serum, go to episode notes for this podcast and click on the C60 Evo link. These products have not been evaluated by the FDA and are not intended to treat, diagnose, or cure. If you have a medical concern, please consult your healthcare provider.
If there's one thing money can't buy, it's sanity. Conspiracy Unlimited with Richard Serrett.
Welcome back. I'm Don Jeffries, again filling in for the incomparable Richard Serrett. Gino, you were talking about something. Please take up where you left off.
Well, I was going to say, you know, with Las Vegas, when someone enters the city in the airplane, by airplane or even by car, you come up down the pass from Los Angeles or from Reno, or in the airplane, you see all these lights. You see 50 square miles of lights, basically. And in those lights are all these casinos. You know, you have so many options. You have every kind of casino you want, every kind of a gambling operation you want. You have themed ones, you have non-themed ones, you have, you know, spa type places to like waterwork type places. So it's really a lot of choices you can make as a tourist. But what I was going to say is, you know, the theory that we had at the Imperial Palace was, you know, fill the rooms and get bodies. And, you know, today, some of the hotels are getting a little carried away with their prices. So say you have to pay $250 for a room, and you got a $1,000 budget. I'm just going to give you an example. So if you're here for 2 days, that's $500 went to the room, and you had a couple hundred dollars to eat. So that's $700. You only got $300 left to gamble for 2 days and, say, play blackjack. Wouldn't it be better if you charged less for the rooms, a little bit less for the food? They'd have more money to play, and if you could keep them in your place, they'd lose all the money back there anyway, and they'd have fun doing it. And that's, I think, a situation that has to be looked at. If I had a place, I would certainly run it like we did in the old days. Good entertainment, clean rooms, not cheap food, but good, inexpensive, subsidized food. Give them a bargain. Give people a bargain. They love that.
Absolutely. You want them spending money. I know. I think Las Vegas used to run the same way as Atlantic City. You know, I don't think I ever paid for a room in Atlantic City. We always got free rooms, and they used to have. I think wasn't Las Vegas famous for their free buffets at one time, or you could get coupons out of a magazine or something, or you know get credits from the casino because they want you spending your money. They want you putting the money in on gambling. So they'll give you a free meal and a free room, won't they?
Exactly. They have a rating system, basically. You know, there's so many hands dealt an hour, and they can calculate how much the theoretical win should be for the casino by how much you're betting. You know, $25 right. a hand, you know, in Baccarat, there's, say, 80 hands times the casino percentage. They know they're going to make X dollars from you. So, yeah, they can then, if you are a real player, you deserve complimentaries. If you're not a player, you shouldn't get complimentaries. Other than free drinks, maybe occasionally. And they have ways, they have tracking systems that are pretty fluent, basically. I mean, pretty exotic, actually. And they can tell you exactly what you did, almost. And that's what they use. They use those things to give you credits. They give you gifts and cash. Well, I designed a casino club for the San Remo Hotel, which is now Hooters, and I called it the Money Club. Instead of giving jackets, hats and cups away, I gave them points, which were cash, converted to cash. You could buy jackets and caps with that money, but I figured that if you give them back the cash, they're going to come back to you and gamble with it. And that was some of the ideas. So, some of the best marketing tools, from the old days could be turned around a little bit and reused, and people would love them.
Sure. I mean, so now let's talk a little bit about the mob and what you saw there. And I'm sure, maybe as you talked about the one guy, you pretty much knew what he was. But, I mean, how overt was the influence in Las Vegas of the mob? Or was it kind of in the background and you just assumed something was there, but you didn't really see, blatant indications of it?
Well, yeah, you knew about it, but you didn't really inquire too much because it was none of your business. But there was instances when I was working at the Dunes where it couldn't be avoided, where certain people would come in who weren't supposed to be there, and the Dunes got in trouble. For one was Nick Savella, who was from Kansas City. He was a notorious mobster, and the Dunes got fined for him, and he also was put on the Nevada blacklist where he couldn't come in any Nevada gaming property. And then a couple of other guys were friends of, for instance, in where I worked, were friends with some of the top guys from St. Louis. And, we couldn't avoid not seeing them and talking to them and dealing with them at the Baccarat table. Nice to us, treated us like gentlemen. But the Dunes basically was the, I would say, let's put it this way, Hoffa was one of the first funders to the Dunes Hotel through Jay Gottlieb. And Hoffa and his union, had all kinds of union representatives in various cities, and they made loans to various casinos, and of course there was undoubtedly kickbacks in some of the situations. And some of those situations, those kickbacks were involved with mobsters. For instance, Mo Dalitz of the Desert Inn, who was a friend of Hoffa, and Mo Dalitz is one of the most respected guys in Las Vegas, but a big operator, ran the Desert Inn Hotel and the Stardust Hotel.
He had some influence in Hollywood. Didn't Mo Dalitz go back to Hollywood too?
Not so much him, no. He was from Detroit. In any event, he built a place called La Costa. La Costa was down there by San Diego, and it was funded by the Teamsters. And it was basically a hangout for the public as well as all the mobsters. And, so Alan Dorfman, who was Hoffa's hand-picked executor of the fund, who did time for a kickback, was a regular customer at the Dunes in some ways. His girlfriend was a cocktail waitress there, and I'll never forget one night, we were making plenty of money off of a customer, tips-wise,
And the cocktail waitress was making nothing because he wasn't drinking. So, you know, we made maybe $3,000-$4,000 off of the guy. And, you know, so I said, let's give the cocktail waitress the next bet for the dealers. And so we put her up for, well, he put her up for $100. She won the bet, and I gave it to her, and she was so excited. You know, she gave me a kiss on the cheek. And later, one of the other bosses says, you know who that is, don't you? That's Alan Dorfman's girlfriend. And I went, oh. So, you know, he was the guy that was assassinated in Chicago. I don't know if you know that. And So, you know, we had a lot of interesting things, and we had guys, you know, that were we had a host at the Dunes. His name was High Goldbaum, and High Goldbaum was a diminutive fella dressed to the hilt, and he used to wear a cologne called White Shoulders. Now, White Shoulders is a woman's perfume. But in the 30s, men used to wear it. And so, you know, I used to sit with him at dinner every night, and he, you know, he'd tell me stories. And he told me a story where he was out here, he came with Bugsy Siegel to work the Flamingo, and he ran the commission sports book inside the place where they took bets from all over the country. All over the country. And if you had a bet you wanted to lay off, you know, you paid a commission fee besides the bet. And, If you won the bet, you got paid. If you lost the bet, you lost the bet and the commission. And he told me, you know, that his phone bill was about $12,000 to $15,000 a month because they had phones that went everywhere all over the country. And the guy from the phone company was called Central Telephone, would come out and, you know, and collect the money in person. He'd bring the bill out to High and say, Hi, here's the bill, and High would pay him. And so one day this telephone guy says to High Goldbaum, he says, Hi. You know, you can buy the company for maybe $50,000. It's rumored for sale. He said, I don't want any of that. And that was the end of that. He turned down buying the phone company, you know, for like $50,000, but his phone bill was $15,000 to $20,000 a month. And he was quite a bookmaker. He was Bugsy Siegel's personal friend, and he was brought to the Flamingo, and then he came to work at the Dunes years later. A lot of strange things and conspiracy things even came up for a bit. But I had a couple bosses I worked for in the Baccarat pit who got in trouble for bookmaking. They had an illegal bookmaking operation in the Dunes Hotel and in one of the apartments. They were being watched, and somebody informed on them, and they got arrested. And a group of 5-6 guys were indicted for a bookmaking operation, and they confiscated a locked cash box in the casino cage from Sidney Wyman, and they got $800,000 out of that box. The FBI, you know, confiscated. And so two of the guys, you know, went to jail. They went to the county farm temporarily because they were in contempt of court for not talking. They wouldn't testify. We had a policy in the Dunes at the time where the bosses were in with a tip, and if you got fired, you were in for a year until you got a job. So it was my job to take the tips to the jail. That sounds crazy, but I actually took the tips, we called them tokes, to the jail, and I gave them their tips in jail. And, this was like a kind of like an honor farm out in the east side of Las Vegas, and the conditions were pretty bad. I mean, the furniture was terrible, and so Mr. Wyman, Sidney Wyman at the Dunes Hotel, bought the entire jail furniture so those guys could be comfortable for a while. And I did that for until they got out of jail. That was quite a trip. Every day, you know, every once a week, I'd go out there and visit them. So not the normal thing that's prison supposed to do, but that's what I did.
Gino, I have to ask you about, you know, my I'm the conspiracy world. That's my favorite part of the world. It's what I write about more than anything else. And the JFK assassination is my wheelhouse issue. I go way back to the mid-70s when I was a teenage volunteer working with Mark Lane's group, Citizens Committee of Inquiry. This has been a part of my life forever.
A lot of respect for Mark Lane.
Oh, he was my hero, my mentor, my hero. But, you know, I became a civil libertarian because of him. There aren't too many of us left these days. But so how did you get involved? Tell us about working with my good friend, John Barbers, on this gratifying friendship I've had. Just a wonderful guy. Still admire him. So 88 years old and has the energy of a teenager. This fantastic documentary, The Second Assassination of President, the American Meeting and the Second Assassination of President John F. Kennedy. How'd you come to be involved with that? Talk a little bit about that.
Well, I met John, and he wanted to do this project, and basically I helped him do the project. And we did a lot of the editing, and we did a lot of the writing, and we put it together. And at the time, my theory was like everyone else's, you know, the CIA did it, and Garrison, you know, Garrison was partially right. But, you know, over the years, I've changed my thinking entirely, completely, and I've gone the other way. My theory was, from the information that I came across, and I don't have all the answers here, but my theory is that I think it was that was the mob. With some other people, and they had some help. And the reason I tell you that is because I didn't want to write this last chapter in one of the chapters in my book, and I don't know if you read this yet, but there were guys in the Baccarat pit that actually knew Jack Ruby. They didn't like him. I mean, they didn't think nothing of him. I worked with a guy by the name of Joe Slayton, Irwin Gordon, Dave Goldberg. They knew Jack Ruby, and John Stone, who was one of the biggest bookmakers, a friend of mine since I was a young teenager. His daughter wound up becoming the sports book manager of the Stardust Hotel for Lefty Rosenthal. And she lived in the same building as Jack Ruby did in Dallas at one time. And there was a guy that came into the dunes quite often. His name was R.D. Matthews. He was frightening. He had a patch over one of his eyes, and he used to pick up the diminutive high gold bomb, and they'd joke. And, you know, High would act like he's choking his neck. He'd pick him up like a little doll and lift him off the ground about 2 feet. And here was a guy you didn't fool with. And he worked for Benny Binion at the time at the Horseshoe Club, legendary Benny Binion. But the funny part is, when Ruby was arrested, they found R.D. Matthews' card in his wallet. And I believe the night before I'd have to look at my notes here. I got so much stuff in this book. And I'm missing so many things, but there was a phone call revealed, a 13-minute phone call from Ruby's Carousel Club in Dallas to Matthews' ex-wife in Shreveport, Louisiana. That was October 3rd, 1963. And it was, it's just one of those things. But all of a sudden, these little clues came up, and I started realizing there was Walt Brown, a former FBI agent, who was a lead investigator at one time. He visited the weapons dealer in Oklahoma where R.D. Matthews had the tools of his trade specially made. And it was kind of R.D. Matthews is a guy that was something else. You'd have to read the book to realize there's so much more about him. But he was actually questioned before the committee, one of the committees, and he took the ex-federal judge who was impeached, Harry Claiborne, as his lawyer. And so anyway, I always had this idea, you know, about things and things I read and so forth and so on. And then one day, and of course, you know, there was a lot of sources asserted that Hoffa had something to do with the assassination of JFK. Frank Regano reported that. That was one thing. And then there was also Edward Parton, who was an associate of Hoffa. He was approached by Hoffa to kill RFK. And the talented researcher and writer Dan Moldea published The Hoffa Wars, the first book to theorize that Hoffa recruited mobsters Marcello and Trafficante to arrange President Kennedy's assassination. Dan Moldea doesn't miss dotting his I's or crossing his T's, and he's thorough. And then one day, this is really crazy, I'm on a patio afternoon in a little restaurant, and I'm writing stuff, and this guy I've known for good 25 years, just happened to be leaving, and he stopped to say hello to me. He said, "What are you doing?" "Oh, I'm just writing this book." He said, "What are you writing the book about?" And I said, "Oh, I'm writing this chapter about Ruby and Kennedy and stuff like that." He said, "We got to get together. I got to talk to you sometime." So I said, "Well, how about now?" And he sat down and started telling me how he was a Marine, ex-Marine, of course. And now let me explain to you what he did. He spent his last 35 years, I think, working at the Desert Inn Hotel, you know, just a little bit after they opened until they closed. And that was owned by Dalitz. And so he worked there as a wheel dealer, as a roulette wheel dealer, and then he moved up into management. But he said, you know, I got out of the Marines and I was a sniper, and we worked in these two-man crews, I think he told me about. There was 50 of them, and they went around the world and did work for a secret part of our government. The fellow that I knew got out of the Marines like 1949. He was basically a sharpshooter and part of a special squad that worked for a general called Chesty Puller. And after that, he went to work down in Alabama, and he got in trouble in North Carolina. And then he finally got, I guess, for doing some moonshine. And he finally ran into a guy in Phoenix City, Alabama, and they put him to work in a casino there. And he learned the games, learned the 21 game, learned how to deal the roulette wheel, we call the wheel, and craps. And, after being there a while, in Las Vegas, they didn't have dealing schools in those days. You know, either you worked in a legal casino somewhere, you learned the game that way, or a friend taught you. But Mo Dalitz at the Desert Inn, I think it was 1953 or so, could have been 54, needed a couple of wheel dealers. So he called his friend in Phoenix City, Alabama, who ran a casino, and he said, "You know, he's looking for a dealer. Do you have anybody that you can recommend and send out here? We need some dealers." And he says, "Yeah, we got a guy. I got a good guy, and he can handle a wheel good. He's a perfect guy for you. And he's got another bonus," this guy said. And he said, Mo Dalitz says, "Yeah, what is it?" He said, "A rifle." He was a sharpshooter. You know, they kind of chuckled at that. And so that was that. He sent him out there. And this was about 53, I believe it was. So, you know, he went into the Desert Inn and got his apron signed in and went to work that next day. And, before Dalitz would come up and introduce himself, he wanted to see if the guy could deal okay. And he could deal fine. He was a fabulous dealer. And so Dalitz introduces himself to him. And he says, "My friend in Phoenix City said you were a pretty good sharpshooter." He said, "Yes, sir. I was in the Marines and did this and did that." And he says, "Well, why don't you go out in the desert one afternoon and shoot a couple of soda cans or something?" You know, kind of joking with him. And he says, "Yeah, I'd love to do that." Now, you got to remember, in 53, you could walk outside the Desert Inn Hotel. That's the desert. You know, you didn't have to go 20 miles to find a place to shoot guns. You know, people did that in those days. So they went out in the desert, you know, maybe half a mile from the Desert Inn, and they set up a quarter, and he popped it. And then he says, "Let me put a dime up," and he popped that. He said, "That's pretty good." He said, "You're a pretty good shot." He said, "That might be a bonus in years to come. Do you have any qualms about shooting somebody if they deserved it?" He said, well, he answered, "Well, if they deserved it, maybe." But he says, "You know, I have a couple of rules." He says, "You know, I never did a kid, never did a woman. Never hurt a woman or a kid in my life, and I wouldn't do it, you know, to this day. Just wouldn't do it. What if you had to protect yourself?" Basically, he says, "Well, that's a different story. Just to go out and assassinate them, I wouldn't do that." So basically, you know, that was that. So nothing ever came of it, but he was promoted to a more of like a director in the hotel eventually, and did special assignments for Mo Dalitz, doing errands, various things. And a few years went by, and one day Mo Dalitz sent out to get some information, and this gentleman came back, and he was told that Mo Dalitz was in the country club on the second floor in a meeting, and to go over there and bring it to him. So he goes to the entrance of the second floor, and there's two guys kind of watching the gate, and they wouldn't let him go up, and so they said, "We'll go up and tell Mr. Dalitz you're here." He did, and Dalitz just sent him up. So he went up there, and Dalitz says, I want you to meet some people here. And Dalitz opened the door to this little small boardroom, and Dalitz said to this group of guys, he said, this is so-and-so. Just wanted you to see who he is and say hello, and we'll talk to you a little later. And he scooted this gentleman out. Well, this anonymous person said he looked in the room, and at the table, and he recognized a couple of faces. Now, this was this was incredible to me. One was Sam Giancana. The other one was Nick Civella. And the third one, which I thought pretty wild, was Lyndon Johnson. And he was a vice president then. Now, you know, the guy told me the story, and that was that. So then a couple of days later, Dalitz calls the gentleman back up, and he says, how do you feel about that? He says, well, he says, you know, like I said, I wouldn't shoot a woman and I wouldn't shoot a kid. And he says, oh, okay. And that was the end of it. Now, what's crazy about this is that I finished my interview with the gentleman, and I said, I would like to do another interview with you a couple days later. And he let me do it again, and I taped it with his permission, and he never missed a beat. And then it was incredible, and I searched my notes, and I looked at listened to the tape, and it was impeccable. And then, just by chance, Mo Dalitz's daughter, who's still around, she was in town, and I called her up, and I said, I'd like you to come over, and I want you to listen to this and meet this gentleman. And he met her, and in my office, he repeated the story. He never missed a beat. It was exactly the same, and she didn't was taken back. She wasn't upset. She just listened. And it was really an incredible story. Now, I then went to the presidential library of Lyndon Johnson, and I looked up his daily diary, and he did go to the Desert Inn Hotel, and I believe he stayed in room 340. He also visited the Tropicana, which at that time was partially owned by Marcello, Carlos Marcello of Louisiana. He was one of the biggest investors there. And Johnny Roselli, who was hired by Robert Mayhew to kill Castro, with Giancana, was also involved in the Tropicana. So, you know, who knows what Dalitz had in mind? So that's the question. But I thought I'd tell you the story, and I thought it was very interesting. So, and then it brings, you know, the connection between Dalitz and Hoffa now are very, very close. It's extremely close. And so I always thought that this could have been something, it could have been nothing, but it's my inclination, I think, that I believe what the gentleman told me. He's still alive. He's quite elderly. But I thought it would be remiss of me if I didn't include this in this book. And that's where it is, Don.
Well, that's great. And give us, because we only have a few minutes left, and I want to give you time at the end to promote. Give us one more. Do you have one more quick story from the book that is especially fascinating?
I'll give you one real quick one. There's many great stories in the book that are just funny and just a lot of fun, and there's a lot of detailed stuff that you couldn't even repeat. It'd take me 10 hours to repeat it to you. But there was a great story. You know, one day I went in to get my shoes shined in the men's room, and I was in the Baccarat pit, took my jacket off and got up on the little pedestal, and the guy shining my shoes, and in comes one of the shift managers in the 21 pit, who used to be my boss. And then, after he comes in, here comes a host that was working for the casino that they didn't get along. These two guys didn't like each other. I mean, to the point they hated each other. So they're both washing their hands, and they're looking at each other in the mirror, kind of like triangulation. And I'm about 5 feet away on the stand. And one guy says to the other guy something smart. The other guy says something back smart. Pretty soon they're pushing each other. One guy reaches in his pocket, pulls out a gun, and somebody yelled, gun, and he hit the other guy in the head, blood squirting all over the place. I'm trying to duck. The shoeshine guy left the rag on my foot, and I can't do anything. Anyway, the casino manager, they took the guy away, they fired him, and that was that. And
one year,
the shift manager was mad at me because I didn't take the gun away. And by the way, can I get my website?
Absolutely. Go ahead. Tell the folks where they can reach you and promote anything you want to promote.
The book can be purchased at trineday.com. That's trineday.com. And my website is Gino Munari, GenoMunari.com. That's GenoMunari.com.
The book is Las Vegas, Dunes, Hotel, Casino, and Country Club, The Mob, The Connections, The Story. Gino Munari, thank you very much.
A new Conspiracy Unlimited with Richard Serrett drops every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at conspiracyunlimitedpodcast.com. Blow your mind. That is all for now. Oh, and remember to share and give a 5-star review because we have huge egos and need love. We're like cats. We need constant petting.